You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 1st, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect, how neoliberalism broke the supply chain. Also on the program today, U.S. and Russia clash at the U.N. Security Council, trying to find a way to avoid a war. EPA will resume its limits on the release of mercury in a Trump reversal. So sorry. For those of you who want a little more mercury in your air. The FDA gives Moderna full approval. Pfizer for kids 6 months and up could be available in weeks. Amnesty International releases a new report. Israel is an apartheid regime. Single-payer bill pulled from the California floor, the last moment foreclosing any opportunity for single payer in California this year. New York Times reports that Trump personally sought to have the DHS seize ballot boxes. Boris Johnson slammed in a new report showing he flouted COVID restrictions. And Pence's former chief of staff testifies in front of the January 6th commission. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Glad to have you here. Also, of course, here with me today is Emma Vigeland. Emma, hello. Welcome.
Hi.
How are you?
Switching it up. I don't know. Doing good.
No, I understand. I'm trying to get my IMs going, and I can't seem to do it for some reason on Adium. So it's not, I don't know, we'll see what's going on there.
Portentous.
Yes. Great to have you here, folks. Thanks for joining us. We'll be talking to David Dayan in a moment. At the moment on Capitol Hill, starting to talk about funding the government. You remember last time we hit the funding deadline, they punted with a continuing resolution. That continuing resolution is, I think it's like 2 or 3 weeks away from expiring. The other issue is, of course, that there is an attempt to break up Build Back Better into smaller components and sew them back up and get them passed through reconciliation. We mentioned the other day that Premier Jayapal has a sense of what Joe Manchin will sign off on. And as he is the king of the United States, we need to have his blessing. Speaking of his blessing, the other issue is Stephen Breyer, of course, has announced his retirement. The Senate is now faced with confirming whoever Joe Biden ends up picking. That process should happen very rapidly. I think if you have any sense of the age of the typical U.S. senator, or at least the Democratic Senate caucus, once that person's confirmed, Breyer can stay on the court until his resignation. It's sort of, I guess, begs the question, couldn't Biden confirm four justices and just wait till the rest go
right.
away?
Make a queue.
I don't know. I guess that's not how it works.
It's like it's their draft picks and they're in the prospect pool.
I mean, I'm not sure if it, I guess maybe it requires someone to say that they're going to They're going to retire. I'm not exactly sure how that works.
I bet Trump could get it done.
Yeah, indeed.
Right.
But here is Joe Manchin, President of the United States, being asked how he feels about President Biden's narrow criteria for an upcoming Supreme Court pick. This, let me tell you something. These slots on the court have had traditions for certain genders and ethnicities for decades.
Or religions before that.
Well, religions, yeah. I mean, in fact, this slot was typically the Jewish slot. I think there was one break in that from, since I think it was from Brandeis. But of course, Kagan is on the court, and Biden's under no obligation for this. But the idea that this is in somehow like a unique situation is absurd.
Well, we laid that out yesterday.
We did.
Republican presidents have had criteria for the identities of their judges for the past few decades.
Well, let's be honest. Presidents have had specific ideas of the identities of Supreme Court picks since the first Supreme Court.
Right.
And it just happens that for, 120 years, it was white men, maybe more, actually, white Protestant men.
And in recent history, the Republican criteria is if you identify as a Heritage Foundation acolyte. So,
right.
I mean, that's a 100% hit rate in that area.
Federalist Society, you're in. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, down to the same high school. Nevertheless, here's Joe Manchin from West Virginia being asked about this narrow requirement.
Are you in favor of having a quick nomination process or confirmation process?
Well, I'm just in favor of basically filling the court. I make sure we don't have a vacancy there for any time at all. So, yes, absolutely. Let's move forward. A lot of the people have been vetted. So we're looking for a good, qualified, competent rule of law person. And I think there's quite a few that have been mentioned. So I'm anxious to see who the president brings forward. And we'll go through the process, judiciary, then we'll pass it on to us, the full body, and then we'll vote. And I'm anxious to do that.
Do you think it would make sense to have this go as fast as the confirmation process did for the last open seat on the court?
Well, it depends on the qualifications of the person. That's the main thing. If you have somebody that's already been vetted, it goes pretty quick. Mm-hmm. So if not, then it goes in a deep dive. And this is the highest court in the land, so it takes time to make sure you get the right person. But there's a lot of qualified people who have been mentioned so far, and I'm sure they're all good people.
Have you spoken to the White House at all about the list?
No, I'm anxious. I just think we need to make sure that we have a full court of nine.
What do you think about the narrow net that he's cast? Just eliminate some black women?
Oh, I think it basically represents, you must represent basically who we are as a nation. I think it's far beyond time, far beyond time. It's time to do it.
Okay?
Thanks, Senator.
All right, so good for Joe Manchin. He wasn't going to take the bait there, of course. I mean, frankly, it was an incredibly offensive question in and of itself. So narrow. But an indication as to maybe where Manchin is there by saying if someone's already been vetted, that'll make the process go a lot quicker. Ketanji Brown Jackson was nominated and confirmed a year ago for I think she's now on the Court of Appeals
in D.C.
Circuit Court, and she had been confirmed for a district court, I believe, during the Obama administration. Not sure exactly which year it was. So, in other words, she's had Senate confirmation. She's passed the Senate before, already been vetted. However, there are some corporatists out there who are looking for a judge who is going to be maybe fulfill sort of some of the requirements that Joe Biden has, but will continue to protect corporate interests. I give you Representative Jim Clyburn pushing an anti-labor judge.
J. Michelle Childs is her name.
I just know Michelle, and she has a kind of background that will offer some diversity to this court. Today, over 50, in the last 50 years, there's never been a person to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States that's a graduate of a public school, undergraduate or law school. What's this notion? That if you don't go to a public school, that you are not qualified? Here's a person with 4 degrees, all from Southern schools. Her zip code disqualifies her. I really believe that we have to get beyond this notion of elitism. There are a lot of people who graduate from public schools, including the current president of the United States of America, who ought to be considered for high office. And so I just think that this thing has built up, and it's bothering a lot of people, including yours truly.
That's really cynical, because,
oh my God.
I mean, I am in full agreement that the, like, orthodoxy with which our government officials treat someone who comes out of Yale Law School or someone who comes out of Harvard Law School or Columbia, I mean, it's ridiculous. And there's elitism in that in and of itself. But he's hiding the ball here and cloaking it on purpose in this, because this J. Michelle Childs, the federal judge Jim Clyburn is urging Biden to name to the Supreme Court, worked for years as an anti-union at an anti-union law firm that boasted it helped companies remain union-free. Childs often defended employers sued in racial discrimination cases. The Prospect article on this said that 23 out of the 25 cases she was on with this law firm was not on the side of the people accusing discrimination, the companies of discrimination. She was representing the corporations in those instances. I mean, she's as anti-union in terms of her background as it can get. And anti-worker, just in general.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the one requirement, except maybe a few exceptions for Supreme Court justices, whatever they are, make sure they're down to coerce workers using the full force of law. And I hate to be like a Jordan Peterson. Let's get some viewpoint diversity and not only look to certain kinds of diversity, but it would be nice if that was the thing we started with, is this person is a pro-worker, and then we can get like a black woman on who's pro-worker, not somebody who has a pedigree of union busting.
And
it's disgusting.
And you can find that.
Sorry to cut you off, but like the problem with Clyburn saying like this public school thing, like that the reason people like that stuff is it's a proxy for these class politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
right.
But Clyburn's saying basically like, oh, we can get a black woman from a non-Ivy League education that's willing to crush unions as well.
The point exactly, and this point is really important, that when we talk about identity and diversity being important in terms of identity, it is a proxy because it presumably means that the likelihood of them being pro, let's say, union or worker, or have a diversity of experience that might lend them to appreciate that they need to fight on behalf of 99% of the people. That's the point. The idea that you can go to a public school and then become essentially a crony to suppress workers' rights, unions, you name it. I don't know. Fight against environmental protections. I mean, we can go on and on. Be in favor of monopolization. I mean, on and on and on. The value of a signifier of going to public schools is that ostensibly they have not been bathed in the ideology of the elite. It doesn't, but it's not it's not definitive.
No, it's not a virtue in and of itself. It is what is created by those experiences.
Presumably. Right.
And of course, someone like Clyburn and Lindsey Graham, by the way, and Tim Scott, who all like her and are all pushing her, that should tell you everything. They are using the fact that she went to a public school in order to push the exact opposite of what that's supposed to engender.
If there is a single moment where a single synapse fires within any individual in the Biden administration, that it is going to behoove them to have bipartisan support for this nominee, they are clinically insane. And I'm not a doctor, and so I don't, you know, I rarely go out on a limb like that, but they're out of their minds. All right. In just a moment, we will have David Day and the executive editor of that same magazine that wrote that piece about exposed Clyburn's push for a union busting lawyer on the Supreme Court. But we have some big news, ladies and gentlemen.
Whoop.
Let's see what we got here.
Da-da-da-da-da. Charge.
This is an official announcement of another live date for the Majority Report. Now, here's the deal. We had had this one in the works to book when we thought the Boston show was January 16th. And then the Boston show got moved to May. And we're working on some great stuff for the Boston show. I got to tell you, I just... it's pretty exciting. I haven't even told you guys about this yet.
Oh.
But we now have a date for a show in a place called Brooklyn, New York. It's at the Bell House. It's going to be March. When is it? Shoot. 23rd? 26th?
Last Saturday in March.
The last Saturday in March, as we call it. If you go to MajorityLive.com, now you'll see there are two dates. Now, listen, here's the deal. The Bell House is about a half to a third the size of the Wilbur. The Wilbur in Boston is nearly sold out. It is at 2 p.m. March 26th in Brooklyn. There's only about 300 seats, maybe? It's going to sell out quick.
We've done, was it two MRs there?
Yeah.
And I think I did two TMBSs there, and everyone has been basically sold out.
Yep. So you got to move on this quick. Got to be quick.
Got to be quick. I went to see a comedy show there, and I got a bunch of margaritas, and it was probably the worst hangover of my life.
It's a fun place to drink.
So just be careful with any margaritas there, but otherwise we're going to have a good time.
And we're 2 months out, and by then I think we're going to be in very... Now, of course, vaccination will be required, and I believe their policy at this point is masking when you're not eating or drinking. Who knows what the situation will be in March at that time, but I would presume that that's going to be the case. It might be if things are really, really calm in Brooklyn by that time, which I think is very possible. Maybe mask will be optional. We'll see. But March 26th, 2 p.m., the Bell House. Go to MajorityLive.com. You can check it out. Also, as always, this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. I've gotten a couple of emails about this. We will play that clip about Joe Rogan. I was on, Hayes' show last night. Okay, now, want to welcome to the program. Welcome back to the program. Oh, there he is. He's already there. The executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan. David, welcome back. I'm here with Emma, as you can see.
Happy New Year. Am I still allowed to say that in February?
Because
I haven't said it to you.
What? That's not true. We've had you on this year.
I don't think so.
I don't think we have.
Oh, well, I was waiting for your video, your Wi-Fi to get approved.
I know you got your
new. I see it has.
No, it's installed and your landline's gone. Remember, that was the last, I don't know why you wouldn't remember that.
Welcome to
you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
Welcome to the 21st century. Now, listen, there's a guy. I want to talk about, you guys have a huge issue on the supply chain. I want to get to that. I also want to ask you at one point about the California single payer situation. I know that you follow California politics. We can get there in a bit. And I imagine you're also busy with some other things these days. But let's go through this. You have a... You've dedicated it. Well, I guess it's going to be a rolling series. How does it work in this era of the internet when you have like an issue of this?
Right. So we put out a special issue that should be arriving, you know, for our print subscribers and mailboxes, in the coming days, entirely about the supply chain mess. And what we're going to do online is every day, we started yesterday, every day for 2 weeks, we're going to put out one of the main pieces from the issue. And it really follows this along from where we begin with the supply chain, which is production, the factories, through ocean shipping, through the ports, through rail, through trucking, through warehouses, through retail, through commodities, and all showing the exact same dynamics, that the policies of the last 40 years of globalization, monopolization, financialization, deregulation, and just-in-time logistics created hidden risk that made the supply chain vulnerable, and it blew up in the pandemic. And this was a deliberate policy choice to sacrifice resiliency for corporate profits and also the alleged bounty of low prices. We made this trade-off to make our supply chains incredibly vulnerable. And now we don't even get the low prices because the supply chain broke. So that's the entire issue, and we take it step by step by step.
And there was one other element, I think, from what I've read from so far that you guys have put out. It's an increase in profits for the shareholders and the C-suite, right? I mean, it's not just we traded resiliency off for efficiency and lower prices. It's because it raises profits.
Oh, absolutely. So, right. You know, we located our factories abroad because it would have cheap labor and environmental standards, so it would be lower cost. The shipping costs raised as a result. So what we had to do was deregulate all of those areas to make trucking a really terribly low paid job, to make rail very cheap and lacking in manpower and security. We did just-in-time logistics because anytime you hold something in inventory, you're not making money off it. And so the philosophy was have low, lean inventories, get everything from one place to the next only when it's needed, and we'll be able to move forward. All of these things were in service to Wall Street. All of these things were in service to shareholders. And it completely discounted and ignored the fact that if any disruption occurred in this process, that it would magnify and ripple out all over the world. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now with over the last 2 years with the pandemic.
All right. So let's go through some of this. I mean, one of the sort of, I guess the, and I don't know if this was the first, where these fall in the context of sort of how these are sequenced, but China is a big part of this. Not so much, I mean, in part, I guess what they're, you know, what they've been doing, but really as a, it's an example of what happened here. I mean, China was sort of like the repository of a lot of the conclusion of a lot of the policies. At one point you say, you write, I think it's in the original piece, that foreign sources create a path dependence. That's what this is about, ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's in Bob Kuttner's piece on China that is out today, actually, and you can read that at prospect.org. Yeah, I mean, the issue is that not only do we have a lot of finished goods that are dependent on Chinese production, but a lot of the component parts are also dependent that way. So even if you have U.S. production of certain finished goods, the components are all coming from China, and they're reliant on that supply chain to bring that over. And so any kind of disruption there is going to create chaos. And because of that reliance, it also creates that path dependency, because the companies who even are domestically oriented, who make their goods here in America, need the smooth flow of free trade from China in order to finish their goods. And so they become part of the China lobby to lower tariffs, to eliminate any kind of national security restrictions on Chinese imports. And so the whole thing kind of builds on itself. And what's really interesting, actually, is in the last year, it is not just COVID that has created the disruptions to production in China. In fact, more so, it's extreme weather events. So the Yangtze River flooded in 2020, and that created a lot of shutdowns at ports and production facilities. An extreme heat wave in China created more use of air conditioning, and because of the various rules and regulations in China, created a complete energy crisis that shut down electricity production at factories and led to a slowdown in production. So the idea is, you know, because I've heard things thrown around, well, how much more do you want goods to cost just so we can stop a once in a century pandemic? But that's not the only thing that can disrupt supply chains. You could have extreme weather. You can have freak events like earthquakes or fires. You can have political unrest. The problem is the engineering itself. A plumber who made a system like this would be fired, because there is the engineering is way too vulnerable to one single point of failure destroying the entire system. And that's what we're seeing.
But what would make you think that we're going to have more extreme weather events?
Well, I mean, ironically, you know, one of the reasons why multinational corporations chased lower costs abroad is because they wanted lower environmental standards, right? The ability to pollute at a cheaper quantity. So
there's a feedback loop here.
There's a feedback loop.
Ironically,
search for low environmental standards is creating the weather crises that is breaking the supply chain. So, yeah.
Is there one? Well, when you're looking at this, I imagine, you know, you're all on a Zoom meeting as you start to divvy up the different sectors that people are working on and the different elements, right? There's two different elements, or I would imagine multiple elements, but there are several different planes in which you examine this,
yeah.
Both, you know, from a geographic location, also from a product location. You can look at it in terms of the various sets of policies. Is there a couple of products that you think demonstrate the wide range of problems that led to this, right? Because there's an ideological umbrella over all of this in many respects, but there are different elements to it, like you say, financialization, deregulation, just in time.
I mean, let's walk through it. We can walk through it at the product level, or we can just walk through it at the level of these ideas, these theories. But semiconductors is one that people talk about a lot, and that has created a serious goods inflation and shortages, particularly in the auto sector, but also in medical technology, which is a story we read about today. The semiconductor sector is very concentrated in terms of production. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, or TSMC, creates a large amount of the semiconductors available that go out to the rest of the world, especially certain types. And the main competitor for that is this company in Japan. And there was a fire at a Japanese factory that makes semiconductors. So just one random fire, like, removed all of the reserve capacity for semiconductor production globally. And this is an input, once again. So even if it's a U.S. factory and we have a U.S. supply chain or a U.S. production facility, the supply chain is international and they need Taiwan to keep producing. Now, Taiwan also sits in an area of the world where it's threatened by Chinese domination. And that could happen at any moment, and that would completely change the game even further for the production of semiconductors around the world. So you have offshoring that is a major factor here. Then you actually get into the moving of that good. So, you know, we have stuff in China. We need to get it to the United States. Shipping, global shipping, has become a very concentrated business. And when these production disruptions occurred, suddenly people needed goods and were willing to pay a premium for them. So the net profit of global shipping companies, of which there are really 10, but they segment themselves into alliances, they call themselves, that are really three. There's really three global shipping alliances. Their net profits in 2021 were more than the combined net profits of those alliances in the years 2010 to 2020 combined.
So in 1 year, they made 10 years worth of profits.
That's right. That's right. And they subsequently, if you think about this, where is the incentive on the part of the ocean shipping industry to fix this problem? Because they are making incredible sums of money off of this chaos.
And now see, this is now okay. Let's just hang in here with shipping for a minute, because originally I had heard, and I guess it was maybe a year ago or so, I somehow then an outdoor barbecue ran into someone who was a shipping broker, and I think she had told me at the time that a big part of this was a function of all the containers were sent to places that they don't normally go to, because they were sending PPE to various places, far-flung places around the globe that didn't normally have a use for this amount of containers, because they get shipped to one place and then products that come from that place get shipped to somewhere else. And it's basically just a pattern that goes back and forth. And there's some type of, like, you know, there's a pattern to it.
That is certainly part of it. And there's a misalignment not only of containers, but also chassis, which are the part of the truck that you put the container on.
Right.
And those are also owned and controlled by the shipping companies largely. And so any kind of shortages on both of those is going to affect us. The problem is that lucrative.
Well, that's hard, because then we're like, if presumably, right, like the reason why prices are being raised, is this just a question of, like, I mean, it's price gouging, right? I mean, that's basically what's going on. I mean, if it's, I understand the concept of
supply and demand. I mean,
well, yes. But I've got a shipping container that is in a place that is going to be that much more expensive to come back, because there's nobody using it to put anything into it when I'm bringing it back to New York, let's say, for instance. It's coming from, I don't know where, but it's coming back to New York, and it's going to come back empty. And so the value of that shipping container, somebody has to subsidize that. And it's not by anybody who's making any money with the product that's in there. So in this instance, they're just raising their rates because they can, essentially.
I mean, that's certainly part of it. It's also the case that they have to account for the fact that they maximize their profits by making the ships bigger. So that, you know, you go one from Shanghai over to Los Angeles and Long Beach, you have a ship that's like as big as the Empire State Building, and that's more cost effective than if you have a smaller ship and you send several of them at once. So every time you do that, that's you know, it changes the time frame in terms of when you can get back and forth, and it's it also changes the number of ports in the United States where we've had severe underinvestment, where you can actually, you know, dock a ship like that. This is why LA and Long Beach, which is one complex, it's they're kind of next to each other, about 40% of all seaborne imports come into one port. So like it's forcing a bottleneck. It's creating this mismatch, this situation. And, you know, to the extent that there's nowhere even to put the empty containers, they've had to stack them inside residential neighborhoods. So
how would you deal with that specifically? I mean, could you say, look, Long Beach is only allowed to issue X number of permits to dock there over the course of a year?
Well, ships are coming there without a permit at all. That's why we have this backlog of 105 ships in the San Pedro Bay.
But could you force the industries to have, like, you need to have smaller ships?
I think one answer to it is to create more ports with the capacity to actually handle ships of any size.
Okay.
And that's through dredging and actual investment in the ports. We have $17 billion from the bipartisan infrastructure bill, but before that time, ports were at a real low point. We look at a listing of the performance index of 500 ports around the world, and most U.S. ports are like in the 300s or less. So there's a particular problem in the United States because, I mean, you know, there's this kind of debate over why is inflation happening a little bit worse here in the United States than it is around the rest of the world? And the Larry Summers of the world say it's because of our increase in the American Rescue Plan of fiscal policy and more spending. But it's really because of the decrepit and very peculiar state of our logistics systems. One part of that is the ports where we haven't invested anything. We found, and this is coming later this week, a 2015 report of the Federal Maritime Commission, which is a commission that was completely defanged in 1998 in something called the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. We'll go back to that in a second. But this 2015 report said, if we increase the imports into this country by a small amount, we are going to be overwhelmed at our ports. And here's what's going to happen. A, B, C, and D. And A, B, C, and D is exactly what is happening right now. So this was not unknown. 7 years ago, a government report predicted everything that's happening right now. And so the idea to me that this is because of demand situation or this is because of some other factor and not the deliberate neglect of our critical systems for logistics and transportation is really crazy to me.
And so, like, I investing in ports makes sense to me, but it also seems to be a doubling down on the global supply chain issues that, like, we've already outlined in this reliance. I mean,
well, yeah, you're absolutely right.
We're a long ways away from essentially getting someone like the Biden administration to invest as heavily as we need to in domestic production. But that's also the solution here.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And that would, of course, relieve pressure on this system to produce and produce in a very immediate way. I mean, if we had reserve capacity, if we had redundancy within the supply chain, so if there's a problem somewhere, you have another supplier that's available and willing. If we kept more inventory in the United States so that we weren't doing this just in time and we didn't need the part on Thursday because we're going to add it to the machine on Friday, that would also help. So all of these things, I think, are parts of a whole. And we do have an entire piece coming later next week on solutions to this. But there's no silver bullet. We have to make the ports better. But yeah, we also have to reduce our reliance so that, you know, it's not just a dire need to fix these ports for our economic security.
I want to talk a little bit. You mentioned that I think Amazon and maybe it was Tesla were starting their own sort of supply chains. And I had an interesting conversation with the guy at the bike shop. I don't know. Again, this was months ago, maybe, where he was telling me about a specific tire that he was trying to get. And his supplier could not get this tire.
Right.
And he had a good relationship with the supplier, and the supplier, you know, supplied a, you know, a significant region of bike shops around the country. And this guy has, you know, just a small sort of neighborhood bike shop. And so he said, you know, so at one point I was like, he couldn't get the bike tires, couldn't get the bike tires. The guy was starting to like say, like, maybe we need to find, you know, some type of replacement for this specific type of bike tire. And he said, I just went on Amazon to see if they had it. And Amazon itself was selling the bike tire. And then he said, like, I wanted to put in and see how many of these bike tires they had. So he kept upping the amount. And he said, they bought all the bike tires. They control all the bike tires now. Well, this specific narrow bike tire, I wasn't familiar with it. But and okay, talk a little bit about this concentration.
Very common. We have a whole piece coming on this issue, that the supply chain crisis has become a consolidating event, particularly for retail. So if you are Jim's bike shop in New York, you're not going to be able to do a whole lot. You're kind of at the mercy of large container ships that are going to get you your bike part to your supplier and then over to you. If you're Amazon, you might have the ability to send your own boat, which they've done. Amazon, Walmart, Home Depot, they have circumvented this by sending their own container ships, sending them to smaller ports like Houston and other places. And more important, Amazon and Walmart in particular have said to their suppliers, okay, you need to supply us first.
Right.
So we have this trickle coming out of the supply chain, right? Most of that trickle is being diverted because the suppliers know if I lose the Walmart account, I'm done.
It's
if I lose the Amazon account, I'm done. And what this does is it raises costs for goods to everybody else, because the only way for the other group of folks to compete is, and the only way for the suppliers to recoup the money they're actually losing by having to force supply the large operators is by raising prices. So it is a consolidating event, and it is also an inflationary event across the rest of the economy. And, you know, we know what the effects of this, of consolidation, are on, communities and workers and all those things. The supply chain crisis has become a consolidating event. And it's also the other problem, of course, is the consolidation within the supply chain itself. I mentioned three shipping company alliances. There are there used to be 40 class one railroads. Now there are essentially four, two handle the east and two handle the west. We see throughout the components of the supply chain concentration that creates a situation where the incentives all run in the direction of, let's keep this thing broken so we can raise our profits, rather than let's fix the thing and smooth it out for everybody.
The you know, one of the things that I see people sometimes react to when they see, you know, how much of a part of China plays in this story. And again, it's not necessarily like Chinese policy per se, as much as it is China becomes a repository in a way for U.S. companies to get cheaper labor, to avoid any type of environmental constraints, et cetera, et cetera. There is, however, you know, there is also the danger, it seems to me, that China can weaponize this advantage they have. You write about how, or I should say maybe it was Kuttner did, how they weaponized it against Australia at certain times. Mm-hmm. Will you talk about that dynamic? Because this is one of those issues, it seems to me, where there's like something for everybody here, right? I mean, if you're concerned about antitrust, this is an antitrust story. If you're concerned that China is going to be a world dominating power, there's a story for you here. If you're concerned about labor practices, you're concerned about the environment, you're concerned about climate change. I mean, there's a hook for everybody here. It's almost like so fractured that nobody can quite get their talons into it in some way, which is why I appreciate the work that you guys are doing with this issue at the Prospect. But talk about what's the dynamic between China and Australia.
Well, I mean, there's no question that when you have one country who makes many of the critical components for electronics that perhaps go into weapon systems, for example, or they make the active ingredients in pharmaceuticals that are critical at a particular moment, or they make most of the world's PPE, which is what we saw at the beginning of the pandemic, that there are sort of national security concerns that are tied up with this mercantilist strategy and the reliance on China as a supplier of these critical goods. And what they've done with Australia, seeking policies that they want and threatening to hold back various goods that are critical to the functioning of Australian society and its economy, is kind of the threat level scenario that some China hawks always talk about. Now you could see this in two ways. Like, one is, you know, the Chinese production executives, they want to make money too. Why would they cut off these supplies? But the fact that we've seen it to a small degree in Australia suggests that there is, you know, at least with some of these state-owned enterprises, a willingness to do so. And I think that the risk goes beyond China wielding this as a weapon, because China might not want to cut off the production of PPE around the world. But when Wuhan has to be shut down because of a pandemic or because of flooding in the Yangtze River or whatever, it's the same practice, right? It's functionally the same thing. The shutdown happens. And so the national security risk here comes from any kind of disruption, whether it's state directed or whether it is, you know, a function of some weather event or even freak accident.
And I would say, I mean, you know, look, it's hard to get a sense of where we are, you know, 20, 30 years down the road. But for those of us who are concerned with the concept of a, you know, a second Cold War with China, or, you know, conflicts over Taiwan, or who knows what it is, the more resilient and self-sufficient we are, the less there is an opportunity for a country like China to try and leverage things provide fodder for the worst instincts of this country.
And look, you know, this isn't theoretical. There are Defense Department reports on all of this showing the level of reliance on particular goods that are critical. But I would say you don't have to be a China hawk to be necessarily worried about this.
Right.
Because,
of course,
the system is fragile, whether it's fragile because you have a country that wants to become a great power and you know, demoralize the United States or cut off the United States or not, is immaterial. The system is fragile anyway, and it's vulnerable to shocks, whether they're state directed or not. So I don't think that you necessarily have to be a China hawk to be worried about this issue.
Talk about the White House report that was released in June about on supply chains. You say that it's actually pretty good. I should also note at this point, because it's just occurred to me, we're wearing the same shirt. and the glasses. I mean, I just
no. I think that
I feel like it's my fault.
Awkward for me not to acknowledge that at this point.
You know, your wardrobe department has been falling down on the job. This was sent to me this morning.
I got
it sent to me, and I was told this would be differentiated from the host.
I got three shirts, and I don't know why we can't get this right, where we can't tell people not to wear one of the three shirts that I have.
But, David, is that more of like a denim-type shirt?
Yes, this is more denim, yeah.
See,
okay.
You're just not blind.
All right.
Sam's just blind. That's
Well, that's also true. But, I mean, yeah. David and I both have glasses, too. Yeah. All right, so let's talk. I didn't mean to derail
I didn't even know that.
I was getting distracted by the fact that, like, I'm looking at you, and I'm like, oh, wait a second. All right, so the White House
report. Well, one has a beard and one doesn't, so we at least got
that's why I had to grow it. So I look like somewhat different from half the guests that we have on this program. All right. So the June report.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing here that's important to realize is that this problem was decades in the making. Like, we created this brittleness, and it could have snapped at any point. It could have snapped under the Obama administration. It could have snapped under the Trump administration. Actually, parts of it did. Like
Sandy, Hurricane Sandy. There was New York City was like 2 days away from like not being able to get food.
That's apparently right. That's right. And it's a function of the same thing. This is just an elongated version of it. So it could have happened under anyone, and it happened to occur under Biden. And the problem that Biden administration faces is that there is a near-term urgency for economic reasons, for political reasons, to alleviate some of these problems. But they can't really be alleviated in with that level of acceleration and speed. And ultimately, to solve the problem, you have to do long-term structural things that will not bear fruit immediately, but will be extremely important for our economic security down the road. And the Biden administration is...
That's like the sweet spot for something that's never going to get done.
Exactly.
Where,
right?
Politicians are going to exert political cachet on a return that's going to happen after they leave office.
Right. I mean, but to an extent, they are doing it. I mean, you know, the increase of, for example, semiconductor facilities in the United States. We just had one named by Intel. That's a function of a long-term thinking about, I mean, that Intel facility is not going to come online until 2025, but it is being built, and it's being built. There's probably going to be some federal subsidization as soon as the USICA or the Competes Act, which is called in the House, passes that offers some subsidization for building these facilities. There is some stuff that they can do in the short term, but it's a difficult situation. I mean, we tangled this for 40 years, and untangling it is going to be a real problem. But the administration is thinking about these things in long-term structural senses, and they're also thinking about, how can we force these markets to behave in some form or fashion through pressure? And we've seen that actually a really good example of that is the meat supply chain. So we've seen middlemen meat processors, which there are like four companies that control between 60 and 85% of all production of beef, pork, chicken. And we've seen prices to grocery stores rise 20%. And while prices that they buy these the inputs from ranchers and farmers have been flat or below, right? So, sorry, someone keeps calling me. The Biden administration has talked about this a lot and hammered home. This is price gouging. This is something that we need to investigate, and has sent out its USDA and the Justice Department to investigate it. And so what happened in December? After rising for close to a year, prices of meat fell in December. And it's, you know, people say that there is no bully pulpit, but there is, and it can be used to a decent effect to get a handle on the, you know, getting rid of the log jams in these particular places. So there are some short-term things, but that report is really more long-term, and it looks at four critical sets of goods, and looks to ways in which through legislative policy and the legislation that's in the House right now, the Competes Act has a very interesting set of monitoring and other types of subsidies to alleviate supply chain congestion. But it also looks at what the various agencies can do to put forward policies that would stop this. But ultimately, if you're going to fix this, you're going to have to bring some stuff back to the United States for production. You're going to have to bring some critical inputs back to the United States. You're going to have to add capacity and you know, move just in time to just in case. You're going to have to regulate. We haven't talked about the trucking industry, which is this horribly low paid enterprise that everyone says there's a trucker shortage, but there isn't. There's a good job shortage and nobody wants to do the job at the price being offered right now. So you have to re-regulate trucking. You have to re-regulate rail. You have to re-regulate ocean shipping. And you have to create a situation where companies are encouraged and through regulation, you know, obligated to act in the public interest rather than the interest of their own shareholders and their own profits.
And you're going to be coming out with more intense description of these solutions in the coming days.
That's right. So if you go to prospect.org/supply chain, you can find every one of these articles. We've put out two major ones and one smaller one so far. We have a major piece coming every day between now and next Friday, and it systematically, I'm really proud of this, it systematically looks at the issue through all of these different lenses. It's absolutely fascinating. We got some great writers and reporters to work on all this stuff, both from our staff and from outside contributors. And I think at the end of it, it tells a real story about what happened over the last 40 years, how we essentially privatized our supply chains, gave them to corporate executives, and they were completely short-sighted about them, and they broke them. And this is what happened, and this is how we can fix it.
That sounds great, and it is incredibly impressive. I want to just turn to a couple other things. One is we should also say, like, you know, we are getting to the point where I guess maybe you know, one of the other things I think that you've done there at the was that's really impressive at the Prospect is the Day One agenda, which I think we're at the point now where it's starting to be clear that it's going to be day 381
right.
Day agenda, right? Or what? Let me do the math here. Wait a second, 581, right, or something like that? 781, I guess.
How many years left in the Biden administration?
Well, I'm suggesting that they're going to start to do that stuff maybe after the midterms. When they've lost the House and the Senate, and
better to do it before to try to keep the House and the Senate, but
well,
mileage may vary.
Well, but no, but I would agree. But they seem to be completely reluctant and fearful of doing anything.
I mean, some of these things do take time because of administrative procedure. I think you're going to see, for example, changes to the overtime rules this fall, which will allow more people to be eligible for overtime. We just saw this week federal contract workers get increases in pay to a $15 an hour minimum wage. That's for close to 500,000 workers got a raise this week. There are some things that are being done, not necessarily to my satisfaction, but I do think that organizations like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Federal Trade Commission, organizations that are in control of you know, real progressives, are going to be doing significant work, and they're not going to wait until after the midterms to do it. So there are some opportunities here. Obviously, some of the big name opportunities, things like lowering prescription drug prices, canceling student debts, changing the marijuana laws to deschedule marijuana from the list of controlled substances. Those things, I think, are running up against White House resistance.
Interesting. Okay. And lastly, you're in California. I know that in the past, we talked about this back in 2017. You had a good understanding of the dynamic that took place when the California single-payer bill got pulled basically went nowhere. This attempt seemed to be a much stronger one. It had cleared the Appropriations Committee in the Assembly, right? I mean, there was a specific sort of idea on how to tax and pay for the single payer in California, if I'm not mistaken. What was your sense of what happened? And we should say it got pulled last night.
Yeah. I mean, it was stronger or at least more robust in, as you said, the actual policy itself and how to pay for it and everything. But this was something that was announced at like the beginning of January. And by the relative silliness of the California legislature, there are deadlines for when bills have to pass out of committees and also out of the legislative body. So an assembly bill has to pass the assembly by January 31st. And they put this bill together at, like, the beginning of January, right? So they had like 3 weeks to, I mean, I know that single payer is kind of an always looming issue, and it's not like they had to educate a lot of people, but you know, the financing, that was kind of a new thing. And they're saying, okay, we're going to put this together and we're going to get it passed in a matter of 3 weeks, even though the same entity, the California State Assembly, blocked it last time. So it did not feel like a serious effort to me, where they were trying to build interest and build, you know, this is the kind of bill that they call them in California, a 2-year bill, where you introduce it in this case in 2021, you educate people for a year about it, and then in 2022 you make the effort to actually try to pass it. And they didn't use 2021, right? They were trying to condense a 2-year bill into 3 weeks. And so that says to me, from a legislative strategy standpoint, wasn't a serious effort. It was a way for certain members of the assembly to, in an election year, show that they are supporters of single payer healthcare. I don't know that it was a real effort to pass it.
Is there any legislators in California who are genuinely interested in trying to get it passed and are going to sort of marshal some type of genuine effort?
I think that remains to be seen. I mean, it took them a while to find someone to even carry this bill. Ash Kalra, who's a state legislator from, I believe, the Central Valley area, is the one who took it on. But the history of single payer in California is that you have one person who carries the bill, and there it's their fight that they take on for years and years. So Sheila Kuehl, who was in the legislature in the 2000s, it was her singular fight, and she got it to the Governor Schwarzenegger's desk twice, where it was vetoed. Then Mark Leno took it on, and then Ricardo Lara, who's now our insurance commissioner, took it on, and then they waited forever to get somebody else to carry it forward. So the test now will be is if Kalra keeps on this and decides to use this year, even though it's abandoned effectively in terms of passage, but uses the year to educate his colleagues and say that this is the framework that we need to take, and then takes it on next year, introduces it again as a 2-year bill so that you have all that time. Now you almost have a 3-year bill, right? You have this year, 2023, to, you know, tell the new legislature about it, and then in 2024 maybe you can pass it. So, but that's where we're at right now. And I should say that look, the absence of Governor Newsom from this is not lost on anybody. I mean, he ran on single payer and he decided not to pursue this in any form or fashion. He is pursuing a more modest reform that would make undocumented folks eligible for Medi-Cal. And that would, you know, and the insurance exchanges, especially now that we have subsidies such that nobody pays more than, I believe, 7% for health insurance. The exchanges have worked pretty well in California to the extent that there's a pretty low amount of uninsured. But as you know, the system is such that it still creates increases for medical bills, and it doesn't restrain costs to the level that single payer would. So I feel like, you know, Newsom deserves to hear about this. He ran on it. Nobody told him that he had to run on it.
Completely run away from it too. I mean, really just pretended like this was not going on. I mean, as far as I can tell from across the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, I know that the state progressive caucus of the state party has said that anybody who didn't support single payer was not going to be someone they endorse. So now they have to look at that in the context of the governor, although I don't even know if there's a Republican running against the governor this year.
Right.
You know, we'll have to see. But I don't think that the prospects certainly aren't very good, but I think that there's a lot of grassroots energy around it, and that needs to be converted finally into some legislative energy.
David Dayan, I cannot encourage people enough to head over to the Prospect, check out what the solutions are. That's coming out in a couple of days, but also what the problems are to our supply lines. And
also, I should say, we do have shirts there. We have T-shirts and things like that. So if you do need something else to wear, that would be an excellent place for you to start is our Prospect store.
I will check out the Prospect store, but let me encourage people to go over and support the Prospect and become and sign up and become members. What do you call it? I know that I have a subscription. I guess that's what it is. I have a subscription.
Yeah, you just go to prospect.org/membership. We do have we call it membership, but yeah, we obviously would appreciate everyone's support. This is the stuff that we do, like in this issue, I don't feel like is done anywhere else.
Nowhere.
And so
not even remotely close.
So if you think there's value in what we do, yes, it does cost money to do it, and we would appreciate and welcome your support, and you get some perks, including potentially a new shirt there.
Wait a second, where's my shirt?
I don't run your membership. I don't know what's going on with you.
You what? You expect preferential treatment?
No, I'm a member. I want my shirt. David Dayan, appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks a lot.
Bye. I never got a shirt. I just didn't get a shirt.
Mm. Well, luckily you know somebody.
Well, he didn't. He seemed to like completely blow it off. The response to my saying I didn't get a shirt is like, hey, you know what? I'll look into it.
Maybe he doesn't think he deserves one.
Yeah, he talks a big game.
Maybe they're careful with the brand.
Yeah.
They don't want you sporting.
He's sort of Gavin Newsomed me. Everybody's going to get a shirt. Oh, where's my shirt? I got to go. The California thing, very disappointing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not shocking to me. Newsom,
it's not shocking. It is incredibly disappointing. And you know, we had an opportunity in New York that went by in a blip as well.
And I think it's becoming clear to me that in order to make the Medicare for All movement nationally more sustainable, I think getting wins like that in California and New York are going to be big before we're talking about this on a national scale.
I mean, possible, but there also needs to be, I mean, there just isn't the broad-based political awareness of it. I mean, I think, you know, a candidate like Sanders who could, you know, at least communicate about it on a national level is helpful, but there needs to be more of that. So there's a greater, or maybe it's, you know, you're back to like maybe a place like Vermont does it, where it's small enough and idiosyncratic enough where you could get away with it. And become a model. All that said, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. Don't forget, you can come see the show live in two places now, both that start with a B, Boston or Brooklyn. Maybe we'll just do exclusively live shows exclusively at places with a B.
Mm-hmm.
Brattleboro.
Boise.
Burlington.
Birmingham.
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 Birmingham. Yeah. I don't know what the Birmingham was.
Birmingham is the... Isn't that how they say it in England? They, like, shorten it. Birmingham.
All right.
You say Budapest.
So. Budapest.
We will be going to Budapest next.
Bucharest.
Good. Okay.
Bismarck.
There we go.
Belarus. That's in the news lately.
Yeah, there we
that's
go.
Not a city.
Great. Nope. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
Yeah, check out patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We had Kevin Bird on. He's a radical scientist. We're talking about Stephen Jay Gould and the long fight against genetic determinism. And we get into like how basically it's just scientific rationalism for how we can continue keeping black people down after Jim Crow. And it's still around, folks. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that episode.
Baltimore.
Bismarck.
I'd like to do Baltimore.
Berlin.
Baltimore.
I love Baltimore. Baltimore is one of my five favorite cities in the country.
Should we have Nomi on? What are the other four?
New York, L.A. Not that interesting. I forget what the other ones are now.
Well, all right. So you have three favorite cities.
Well,
New York, L.A., Baltimore.
I put it like, you know, I just think it's underrated is all I'm saying. I like Baltimore.
Nomi.
What's up?
Top five cities.
Top five in the U.S. or everywhere?
U.S.
Okay. Just saying. New York, obviously. San Francisco. San Juan, Puerto Rico. Definitely an underrated city. Let's see what else. Santa Fe. I think it's kind of cool and fun. Like, fun little vibes. I know I'm missing something. Why did you put me on the spot like this?
Because it's my fault.
Tucson, Arizona. I didn't think that because I was born there, but I had friends visit me last year there with my family, and they were like, this is pretty exceptional as a city. Is that five?
Yeah, I think it's pretty close.
Chicago should be there because it's an all-star city. I'm going to throw that in. I'll replace Santa Fe with Chicago.
I'm Minneapolis, Chicago, Seattle, New York, and then Denver. Denver and Phoenix.
Ugh, sorry, Denver. What?
I've never been to Seattle.
Do you like strip malls? Is that like your idea of fun? Is strip malls?
That is true. It's a little bit too strip mall.
Gun restaurants. Lord Bober.
For me, I would say Worcester, Lowell, Pawtucket, Holyoke, and Stoughton. I would say.
You should go run for office, dude.
Not necessarily in that order.
God, I mean,
that's a political statement. Are you running for office? Like, come on.
Pawtucket's in Rhode Island.
It's a suburb.
No,
I like Minneapolis too.
What?
Yeah,
it's a great city.
Top five. I don't know.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. You can IM us at majorityapp.com, or you can IM us through the app, which you can get for free at majorityapp.com. Probably won't take phone calls today. Got a lot of things to talk about and go through. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Nightmare!
Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 black,
black. When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Come on. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.